Hungry for spicy food and even hotter conversations? Craving community and authentic storytelling? Then join the table. This is Minor Legends, a new comedy fiction podcast supported by Potluck. Pull up every week with me, Angela Wong Carbone, and follow the stories of me and my friends as we serve up tasty tales of what it means to be Asian American at our weekly dinner hang. If you enjoy deep dishing on absurd stereotypes like tiger moms who tutor your dating game rather than grades, the insanity of your parents' immigration story, to the legend of that one good Asian cousin you can never live up to, then pull up a seat and grab a plate. Featuring dinner guests like Ronnie Chang, Brian Park, Usama Siddiqui, Celia Au, Perry Young, Supriya Ganesh, and more. It's a tasty rotation that'll leave you belly laughing and steeped in relatable and spicy conversations. Can you take the heat? Listen now for free wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to
Whoa!
Potluck.
And welcome to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yue.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And on this episode, we have an author chat with Mike Corrado, the author illustrator of the graphic novel Gaysians, that just released earlier this month. As always, Books and Boba is supported in part by you, our listeners. So if you've been enjoying this podcast and would like to become a bigger part of our book club, head on over to patreon.com/booksandboba, where as an official Patreon supporter, you gain access to our members-only Discord server. And if you join at the Honey Boba tier, you also gain access to our monthly bonus podcast, as well as the opportunity to help us pick one of our book club picks every quarter.
Yeah, but for those of you who have not heard of the book Gaysians, it is a graphic novel that pretty much follows four gay Asians living in Seattle, and it's about found family, you know, navigating love and identity and friendship. We had a really great time talking to Mike, and I hope you guys enjoyed this conversation.
Yeah, so without further ado, please enjoy our author chat with Mike Corrado.
And we are here with Mike Corrado, who is best known for his Little Elliot picture book series and young adult graphic novel Flamer, which won the 2020 Lambda Literary Award for LGBTQ young adult. And we're here to talk about his newest book, his adult debut, Gaysians. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Hi, Rira. Thanks for having me.
So I like to start our conversations with little icebreakers. And since your book takes place in Seattle, which is the coffee capital of America, what is your coffee order?
Okay, America, I don't drink coffee. I don't drink coffee very often. It's like I have one if I really need like a caffeine bump. Like I'm like on the road, you know, I'll have an iced coffee or an iced Americano or something like that to just keep me awake. But I should say I was drinking like just house drip coffee that my partner makes, like when I was the last month or two working on Gaysians, because I was working so late every night.
There's nothing wrong with being a functional coffee drinker. I think that's a very valid way to consume this beverage. Like, I have newborn twins at home, and like it's just all functional coffee for me. I have no time to like be fancy at all.
Right.
Yeah.
But that said, I did work as a barista at Starbucks my first year in Seattle. So,
oh wow,
I was trying out all different kinds of things and getting the shakes every day. I was like, oh, maybe I should stop.
Well, maybe more thematically. Do you drink like milk tea boba drinks at all?
Yes, I love boba. That's a nice little treat. I am a tea person. Definitely I need hot tea in the winter, in the fall. And I love iced tea once it warms up.
Yeah.
And that for that I like a variety, you know.
What's your go-to? Like if you enter a new, if you're trying out a new tea place, like what's the drink you order to like kind of test the quality of this new establishment.
Ooh, okay. I mean, I love a jasmine tea. Mm-hmm. Like, if I can mm-hmm. get, like, a beautiful jasmine pearl tea, I love that. But I also love, like, rooibos and a mint tea sometimes. Mm-hmm. You know, chamomile's nice standby. But, yeah. I just had this incredible... I was in Santa Monica with a friend. We went to a farmer's market and we got this peach oolong tea that was incredible.
That sounds so good.
It was fresh. Yeah, it was like a family-owned business. We bought that and we bought this like hibiscus rose. And I'm usually not a rose person, but this was incredible. I'm like, it does not taste like soap. So fresh. So we made a bunch of iced tea with that. And yeah.
That's great. Right. Yeah, I'm so glad that, you know, it's summer, so all the boba shops here are switching to their summer seasonal menus, and I'm like, yes, Sunrite has returned the peach oolong teas.
Yes.
I'm so happy.
It is peach season,
so
yeah.
Good.
It is peach season. Amazing. Mike, like, you are an illustrator and, you know, also you've written your own books, but how did you get started in drawing?
I've always been drawing. I mean, I came out drawing, came out of my mom drawing. I don't mean I came out as gay and started drawing. Ever since I was a kid, that's what I loved to do. And then I went to college for illustration. And then it took me 10 years after graduating to break into publishing. And I started in children's books. So I have lots of picture books for the littles. I have a series called Little Elliot. And I've gotten to illustrate for a lot of other people. Then I got into young adult with Flamer. And now this is my first adult book with Gaysians.
Yeah, I know that you based AJ's story partially on your own personal experiences. I mean, you just said that you used to work as a barista for Starbucks, and you too moved to Seattle after college in the early 2000s. And I do know that this book took you a long time to write. So what made you want to reflect on your history like 20 years later and write a book about it?
Yeah, I mean... I like to make books that I want to read. I was just craving more gay Asian representation. We don't often see queer Asian stories centered, not in Western culture, at least. So I thought about, you know, that time of my life when I first come out and I made my first gay Asian friends, and I didn't really realize in that moment, like, how important those friendships were. And it was really important that I had these people in my life who saw me and understood me in this really three-dimensional way. And I want that for other queer Asian folks. Like, I want them to feel at home in the book. I want them to feel seen. I wanted to make something for us. And everyone else is, of course, welcome and encouraged to read it. And I just see a lot of queer Asian characters as side characters, and they're not fully fleshed out oftentimes, you know, or they fall into some kind of trope. And I do play with stereotypes in this book, but I think, you know, we start there and then we really learn who these people are over the course of the story.
Yeah, I feel like stereotypes, like tropes, are sometimes they're a starting point for people to relate to each other. And then, you know, once you have that starting point, you start building the nuance. And something that I really did enjoy, did feel while reading your book was this, you know, we talk a lot about, especially in, you know, today's situation, what's going on, where we are in LA, where just in the country in general, like, community has become more important than ever. And, you know, we talk a lot about how, like, when institutions fail, like, community usually rushes in and kind of fills in the gaps. And that's something that,
right,
you know, your characters, you know, experience, and something definitely for those of us who have been in community with other people, your book definitely like captures that feeling of like, okay, like, this is a community that is filling in the places that like these characters are missing with like their own support structures, right, back home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think community building and chosen family are really strong themes in the book. They're definitely characters who already do a lot, or there's one character who does a lot for her community in the book. And by the end, you know, I think everyone sees the value in that. And it is something that I want to see more of. I think you're right. I think this is a really important time that we can't be insular. We need to connect with others and support each other through this time. You know, we need to promote mutual aid. Because who else is going to do it then? Like, we have to do it for ourselves and the people we care about.
Yeah, definitely. I agree with that. Like, we're talking about community and like how, like, when you met your first gay Asian friends, they saw you in a three-dimensional way. And AJ is fortuitous enough to fall under the wing of seasoned gay Asians who are willing to show him the ropes into Seattle gay community. And then they call themselves the Boy Luck Club in the beginning. I thought that was like so funny. So like when you say three-dimensional way, like how does that translate into AJ's initiation into this queer community in Seattle, and what makes the Boy Luck Club so special?
Yeah. So for people who haven't read the book, AJ is kind of our entry point character. He's the newbie who moves to Seattle. He's just come out of the closet and he just doesn't know how everything works. You know, he's like, I don't know how to be gay, you know, quote unquote gay in the gay community. I don't know what I'm doing. And he goes to his first gay bar, and that's where he meets Kay, who is sort of the matriarch of the family. And she's the one that kind of pulls him into the group. So, I mean, for AJ, he's like, you know, brought up in maybe a more conservative household. He doesn't have a lot of exposure to gay culture. He's like literally learning vocabulary words from these people. And he's like, what is that? Like, what is a rice queen? Like, what are you talking about? You know, and they're like, you're Asian, right? Like, he's like, yes. So, you know, and it's not just like these cultural references, but like he hasn't dated men before. He doesn't know how to dress for things necessarily, or he doesn't know how to flirt with people. He doesn't know anything about gay sex. You know, I mean, these people are filling in stuff for him, like giving him information that where else would he have gotten it from? This is also set in 2003. And, you know, I mean, Google was around, but there wasn't like, I mean, there were online communities, but I know for me, I don't know, I was too scared to even enter the chat, you know.
This was before dating apps too, like there were
way
dating
before
websites,
dating apps,
but yeah,
there were dating websites, and yes, there is website experience, dating experience in the book. Also many of those details taken from my own experience.
Some of those dates are so disastrous in the book.
Yeah. In my 20s, I was like, I should just write a book about all the awful dates I've been on. I went on good dates too. So I don't want anyone coming out of the woodwork like hating on me. But you know, dating is messy. I mean, I think most people don't know what they're doing with dating. And there's a lot of trial and error, and that is what AJ ultimately has to do, is just try things out and fail. And his new friends are there to pick him back up, though. And that's very much what my friends did for me. You know, they were just very encouraging, and it'd be like, you know, awful date after awful date. And they're like, yeah, it's just part of the process. It's fine. you know, and they were sounding bored. I'm like, what do you think of this? He said these things, he did this, or like, he hasn't called yet. What do you think? And, you know, you get your friend's honest, unfiltered opinion. Like, that's really important.
Yeah. And also it's like, give me the down low on how Asians fall under this hierarchy of of like the gay community. And I do want to like dive into that a little bit later. But how was it switching gears from writing children's books and YA books to adult, to the adult category? Because your graphic novel Flamer, I know that it got banned for a while. Mm-hmm. And
it's still getting banned.
Oh, yeah. It's still getting banned. Okay. Well,
lots of books are still getting banned. It's still very much a problem.
Yeah. But you don't have to worry about that with your adult debut, right? Like,
well, yes and no. I mean, most of the book banning has occurred in schools, and this is an adult book, and it's not meant for schools. Flamer is a young adult book, and it is meant for schools. But there are still book challenges that happen in public libraries. So it's not just restricted to children's books. We're still seeing adult books being challenged and banned as well. And just to clarify, so a book challenge is when someone wants to have a book removed. You know, there's like a formal process. There's a complaint filed. I don't think this book should be here because XYZ. And then it's up to that institution to either go through with it or not. And if they do go through with it, then that's a book ban when it's actually taken off the shelf. And of course, there's like vigilante book banning where people just go into a library and steal the book.
And steal the books, yeah.
Which has happened to my book in both, you know, school and public libraries. You know, I've heard reports from librarians. And then there's soft censorship, right, where librarians and booksellers are maybe too scared to stock a book or buy one for their library system. So anyway, I could go on about that, but what was your original question?
switching from like writing for children to adults.
It was very liberating, right? Because I'm not, it was just unfiltered, right? I'm not thinking about, oh, how do I want to communicate this to the age group that I'm writing for? So like when I wrote Flamer, I was very much trying to put myself into my 14-year-old self's shoes. And what was I thinking and what would I say? Maybe not the same things that I would say now as an adult. Because that's going to be more relatable to my target reader. But now, as a 44-year-old, I've got a lot more to say. It felt good to just get it out of my system, you know?
Yeah, I mean, this is a pretty thick book. There's like over 350 pages. Like, how long did it take you to draw all these panels and get the story all contained?
I think about 10,000 years. That's what it feels like. I started writing it in 2020. And I finished writing it in 22. And that's when we sold it. And then I delivered the art towards the end of 2024. All that said, I was also working on other books during that time. So I had other books I had to illustrate. So there's a lot of stop and go, but it was a tremendous amount of work. The last few months of production, I ended up contracting some folks to help me finish up the color. So a lot of the flat color, some other folks helped with, but I did all of the line work and all the washes and shading. And I also had an assistant who was like drawing like word bubbles and that sort of thing. It's a huge task. I was tired a lot of the time.
And like, and your line art is so detailed too. So I was just like, wow, yeah, this must have taken him such a long time, especially with like the character designs. Like, I mean, I rarely see like Asian characters in graphic format that look so distinct, so different from each other.
Yes.
Like, and it must have taken so much work to get the look just right.
Yeah. Yeah. There are very expressive illustrations too. Like, you definitely see like the emotions in their faces. It was really impressive to look at.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for noticing and saying that, because about how distinct they are, because that was the goal, the main goal behind creating this style, which is very different from a lot of my other work. I wanted the characters to look like real Asian people. And I feel like oftentimes in comics, we get westernized. And I'm like, I just want people to be able to see themselves, you know, like, because I think it really makes a difference. Like, I know I struggle with like body image stuff. And I think a lot of like people of color in Western culture do, in American culture do, right? Where it's like, there's a mainstream idealism of what beauty is. And we don't often see people who look like us lumped into that. And I think that started to change a little, but it's still like not every day that you see that. So it's like, yeah, I want to celebrate our faces, right? And like normalize Asian beauty. And that is something I feel like my friends were able to show me, you know, they're like, that I'm beautiful, you know? So yeah, I want people to look at these characters and be like, they're hot. They're hot and I look like them. Work.
Yeah, I'm just so impressed by like the diversity of your characters and like their unique personality traits, and like just the way they look, they look different. And I'm just curious, like, how did you come up with your cast? Were the main Gaijins always AJ, K, John, and Steven, or did you have like more characters that you had to like cut in the editing process?
Good question. Yeah, the answer is yes. So there are two supporting characters in the book, Ty and Eddie, and they used to be main characters. Mm. So, you know, and you mentioned how they call themselves the Boy Luck Club. So they are also part of the Boy Luck Club. And I was very inspired by the Joy Luck Club growing up, obsessed with the movie, and then read the book as an adult. And so I kind of used that as a jumping off place. I mean, Amy Tan is a genius. So I just was kind of looking what she was doing with an ensemble cast, because that's something I had never done before. So that was my starting place. And then I ended up doing my own thing. But there were six main characters. And by the time I finished the first draft, it was just so long that my agent said, you know, this is going to be a 1,000-page graphic novel once you like draw all this out. Like, you have to make some cuts, and I think you should cut the cast to three. And I was like, three? So I really had to advocate for John, but then my second draft, she's like, no, this is good. Like, I'm glad you kept John. And I ended up kind of borrowing from Eddie and Ty a few things and giving them to other characters. But they have their own subplots that got completely cut. They're just kind of, they're more two-dimensional characters in the story that just kind of come in to support every now and then. And they were important to me to keep them in the story somehow, because they are an Asian couple. Like, I really wanted people to see an Asian couple. Who are happy, you know,
who are happy,
who are happy. And the four main characters, none of them have a significant other. One of them is in love with another one who is not into him. you know, and then there's AJ, who's just starting out. And then, I just said John fell for Stephen, but Stephen did not return sentiment. And then AJ's stumbling around with new dating, and Kay has better things to do at the moment. We don't really hear her talk about needing a man because she's got her own stuff to take care of. So,
as she should. Yeah. Take
care
of yourself first.
Exactly. Yeah,
I get it. I mean, it's like the whole, like, you know, in a classic sitcom, right? Once the main characters pair up, it kind of goes downhill, a lot of people say. But mm-hmm. at the same time, it's also really cool just to see two people in a healthy relationship that, you know, less drama, but also, I think that's fun. As someone who's also like in his early 40s, something that, you know, sometimes you just want a chill relationship to like aspire to. But
right.
That does bum me out because I did like Ty and Eddie, especially like, you know, they were introduced to them and like they take the role of like something that I've done a lot of times before is like dim sum guy to their friends. Like,
also they're like academics too. So I was like, oh yeah, like Asians in like academia, that's like a whole different thing.
And that was definitely, so Ty is the academic and Ty had this whole, there's a whole subplot about his struggles working in academia. And I should share that I interviewed about 30 people when I was working on this story. Because obviously I'm writing outside of my own experience with characters who aren't AJ. So talking to people of different ethnicities and gender expression and, you know, different occupations and tax brackets and religions and on and on and on. But that was definitely a story that someone very close to me shared, you know, like, I mean, I saw what he went through, and I ended up talking to a bunch of Asian academics actually for this project. So, so who knows, maybe there will be a spinoff. I don't know. Ty and Eddie.
Yeah.
And then those guys.
I will say the scenes where you have all the characters together, I really love like all the banter. Like one of my favorite scenes is just, I really related to it as someone who has, you know, worked a long time in Asian American community, narrative change work, like, when they're talking about how, like, why do we always have to talk about being Asian? And it's like, well, we kind of have to until it's not, like, necessary anymore. And I felt that so hard.
Right. Yeah. It's real. It's like, it's exciting to be able to talk about, you know, the Asian experience with other people who understand. And also, yeah, it can be really draining sometimes. So I get it. I get the need for it and the need to take a break. Sometimes, but
yeah,
I'm always going to want to eat Asian food though, whatever we're talking about.
Hands down. Yeah,
it's true.
You mentioned that you interviewed like all these people for the research of your book, and actually, like, one of the questions I had was like how did you make sure the representations felt authentic while writing outside of your lane? And just like, can you walk us through like how you got people to talk to you? Like, how, like, did you reach out to them first? Was it like cold emails?
Yeah, I mean, so I started off just interviewing friends, people who I knew, and then acquaintances. And then I would ask all of them, like, is there anyone else you think I should speak to? And even some non-Asian friends, I would talk to them and be like, oh, you should totally speak to so-and-so. So, yeah, it was just kind of a natural process. I had already started writing, and I would just kind of take whatever was inspiring me from those conversations and like weave it into the storyline. And you know, I started to see a lot of patterns, like a lot of shared experience. And then I saw like how different we all are. And that's another goal of the book, was to show, okay, we all have maybe a few common struggles and maybe a few common things we can be proud of, but we're not a monolith. And at the end of the day, we're each just people, and we want to be seen as individual people. So yeah, there's this sort of, I think, push and pull of like who we are as a collective, and who we are as individuals.
Yeah, I thought you did, like, your characters are all different ethnicities, and I was like, wow, like he like nailed the details of like specific Asians, because, you know, I'm Korean, and I was like, yeah, like I can read that, because there was like there was Korean in the book, and I was like, oh no, like, yeah, this is when like people think that you don't speak the language, but you do, and you have to hear something very like criticizing towards you, and it's like,
My Filipino is terrible. Like I wasn't taught it, and my dad, you know, most people just assume all Filipinos speak Tagalog, and it's like, no, that's not true. Like, lots of Filipinos speak different languages. So like my dad knows Tagalog as a second language. Like he speaks Bisaya, you know, like our people speak Bisaya. So, and John is a Korean adoptee, and he's raised by, like a multiracial couple, who are not Korean, and they try, you know, they try their best to, you know, show John his culture growing up, but yeah, he can't speak the language. And yeah, there is that awkward scene where a Korean woman is trying to speak to him and kind of shames him a little, but in like that cute auntie way, but still. Yeah.
It's just like, hey, even though I don't understand what you're saying, I totally understand what you're saying, because the shade is, there's a tone to your voice. So your book touches on the subject of like how white centric gay spaces can be, and like why some queer people of color might seek white partners. And I thought that was really interesting. Can you elaborate more on those observations?
Yeah, you know, I think it's something that can be a little awkward to talk about, but it's definitely a thing. It's I'm just saying, like, in general, right? It's definitely a thing that like people talk about amongst themselves, but maybe not always like publicly, right? Yeah, it is. I mean, race in general in this country, right, is whiteness is where the power is centered in this country. And so I think, you know, it plays out in microcosms as well. So once you move over to the gay community, you've got, this sort of, social pecking order. And obviously I'm not saying like, everyone wants it to be that way, but it's definitely something that I have noticed and other people I've talked to feel. And I think, you know, there's a larger conversation, not just about gay Asians and white gay people, but just Asians and white people in general in this country, right? There's this the myth of the model minority, right, that we get relegated to. And, you know, it comes from immigrant culture, right? Like Asian folks moving here be like, okay, we don't want to rock the boat. We're just trying to succeed. We're just trying to like, we just came from a hard place. We're trying to like fit in. We want our children to be safe. We want to like earn enough money, you know, and I feel like those were common goals, right, for Asian families like coming here. Just be like, just keep your head down and take care of each other, right? And so it over time it ends up being like, okay, we're kind of now supporting a system, right? That's
white
upholding
supremacy. Yeah.
White supremacy. Right. So we have to actively work against that now. Like we cannot keep our heads down and we have to speak out against injustices. And we have not always been historically model minorities. That is what white supremacists would like everyone to think. But there have been many Asian activists in history, in American history, who have made some waves. I mean, there were Filipino migrant workers who were aligning with, you know, their Latinx co-workers, you know, in the fields, trying to fight for their rights. We had, yeah, like lots of different groups. Anyway, I'm getting away from the main topic, but I think all of those cultural dynamics that play just continue to play out within gay culture. And so you do see maybe couplings of, you know, an Asian guy chasing after a white guy. And it is something that I've seen, and I'm not trying to hate on anyone, but it's just something that seems very obvious. And I will own, like, I'm gay, I'm Asian, and I have a white partner, right? And I think it's a matter of reviewing what your reasons are for being with someone, right?
Yeah. Like, I feel like I was actually pretty surprised by like the conversation on like, oh, like gay people of color often pairing up with white gay partners. And I was like, I mean, we kind of see that in heteronormative straight dating, because like, you know, white women are like what the pinnacle are considered like the prize when it comes to dating for a lot of straight men. And yeah, like as someone who has a white partner, like there's also like a lot of judgment that's thrown like our way, like thrown my way. And it's like, hey, not everything falls into this stereotypical thinking. Some of us have done the soul searching. And I mean, like, for example, when I started dating my husband, I like made sure to go on Facebook and made sure he wasn't like into Asian girls. And
Oh, yeah.
Was it into anime? Like, you know, like I did my research.
Yeah. And I think Asian people often, like gay Asian people and Asian women, are often like fetishized. So that was always something that I was very like self-conscious about when I was dating, like, oh, why do you like me? Is it because you like me, or you want me to like walk on your back or something? And also I just want to say I'm mixed race. So obviously I don't believe that like white people and Asian people shouldn't pair up. I think that's fine. But yeah, I think it's all about why are you with this person? Is it because you love them, or is it because like, oh, I feel a certain status from being with this person?
Yeah, I mean, we you know, we talked about the conversation that your characters have about like, hey, can we talk about other stuff besides being Asian? And like, no, this is what we want to talk about each other. I mean, I feel like there's a lot of these conversations that you're having in your book that I think about, you know, the people that don't have community or don't have people to talk to about it. And your book might be the first time they're actually seeing people talk about these things, right? Like, you know, you go into one of the first conversations about like, you mentioned the rice queens, right? People who, white dudes that only date Asian dudes. But it's like, I think there's, you know, you have that nuance in your conversations. Like, there's nothing inherently wrong about that, but there is kind of a power dynamic that you have to like be aware of. Like, here's how you, here are the red flags to look for, right?
Right. Yeah.
So I guess, you know, the book's been out for a little bit. Have you gotten any feedback from your readers about like, you know, the things you talk about, like how they relate to it?
Yeah, I mean, so far the response from gay Asian people who have read the book has been really positive. We'll see if that continues to be the case. But I've only heard from like really excited people. And, you know, something I should share is that when I was interviewing people, a lot of the interviewees would say things like, oh, you know, no one's ever asked me that question before. And like by the end of the interview, a lot of people were like, thank you so much for doing this. You know, like this means something to me that you're doing this. And so that gave me a lot of inspiration and fuel to make all this. Sometimes it's interesting having a minority experience, and you're, when you're like constantly gaslit or like constantly like people are telling you, like, no, that couldn't be true. And it's like, well, but I'm living it and I'm talking to people who have also lived it. So I think it was really validating for me and for the interviewees, like just our conversations. So I hope that the book is landing like that for readers. But yeah, I'm on tour right now. The book came out June 3rd. And it's been really exciting to see Gaysian folks turn up to events at, like, people who I don't know just saying, like, I'm so excited that this exists. So, yeah.
So, like, all of the relationships in your book are tested, especially after Kay survives an assault. And your book is very much about chosen family. So what do you think holds a chosen family together when life is trying to tear them down and apart?
I mean, you know, not to give away too much, but I think this is a group of friends who are torn apart by the world, and they become chosen family when they actively choose to show up for each other. Like, it's each one has to make a decision, right? Like, am I going to be here for the people I say I care about, or are we just going to go our separate ways and do our own things, you know? So it's just the act of showing up, of like walking through the fire together. And that's what forges the chosen family. Sometimes we don't know how to help, right? Our friend can be going through it and we can own, like, I don't know what to do, but I'm here and you can tell me what you'd like me to do. I can bring you some pizza. I can listen to you talk. But I think just simple acts like that make such a difference in someone's life, just knowing that you don't have to go through struggles alone.
Yeah, like showing up is a really big part of being part of a village. And I feel like a lot of people have forgotten that. Like, people are like, where's the village? And I'm like, well, have you shown up? Like, have you like looked after your friends, your neighbors? Yeah, it's like a very small but crucial thing when it comes to holding a family together. So I think you showed that beautifully in your book.
Thanks. And just a quick note, I think while it's great to get online support, I think it's also really important to show up in person for people. Like, obviously we can't be everywhere at once, and like people that I live far away from, I'm going to like send a text or call. But I think it is important to like share physical community space sometimes, like get a hug from someone. Don't just send a reel.
Speaking of reel, I am curious because your book is technically a historical fiction book because it takes place in the early 2000s and now we're in like the 2020s. Is there anything that you've observed that like you're like, wow, Gen Z Gaysians, they like this is very different from back in my day?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just like Gen Z gays in general. I don't know, you know, everything revolves around the phone now. It wasn't like that when I was in my 20s because there weren't smartphones yet. There's that. Yeah, I feel like communication maybe is a little weird. I feel like maybe some younger folks, I'm like, why can't you just reply to a message? Like, why is this hard? Or if like I try to call someone on the phone, it's like, oh my God, you're like calling me on the phone. We're like, why are you doing that? It's like, because I just need to talk to someone. I just need information. I don't know. I don't know. I love the younger generation so because I feel like maybe there's just some, I don't even know how to put it. Like, there are obviously more woke than my generation was. So I feel like a lot of younger queer people are more open-minded and not so like a single narrative about a lot of things, especially sexuality and gender. I love that the younger generations are much more fluid and like not, I don't know, like shocked by a lot.
No. I mean, in a world of TikTok where you get to see other people's lives, it's like, oh, yeah, that's how you can live.
They have more exposure to, yes, exactly, different ways of living, and that's wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, times are definitely also changing. Like you mentioned in the wedding banquet in your book, you know, Andrew Ahn just released his update to the wedding banquet, and you know, something he said on the interview really like stuck with me, which is like, it's, you know, when you update something for a new generation, you have to look at like the new situation. You know, wedding banquet, the original was all about like kind of hiding who you are to your family, whereas the new one is you know, about like, you know, building family now that you have like, you know, you're able to, right? And you know, since your book takes place in between those two time periods, it's like I see it as like exploring a time when it was all about building community and figuring that out for the first time for a lot of people.
Yes, right? Yeah, definitely. And I love the Wedding Banquet reboot, and it's so funny because I didn't know it was coming out when I referenced the original one in the book, and so when the trailer came out, I was like, oh my gosh, you're kidding. And it's like coming out right before the book comes out. And I went to see it and I was like laughing and crying. Like, it's a wonderful movie. They did a great job.
Yeah.
Andrew Ahn, gay filmmaker icon, because Spa Night was also incredible. So, for our listeners who have not checked out Andrew Ahn films, go check them out. They're great.
Totally.
Marvin, did you have any more questions?
I mean, I have like one kind of more craft question that I like to ask our graphic artists, which is like, you know, writing a book seems hard already. Writing a graphic novel to me just seems like it's just a quagmire of like multitasking, where you have to not only write the story, write the characters, figure out the plot, but also draw it. So what's your like, you know, you've done a couple graphic novels now. Like, what is your like kind of process? And do you write the story first and then draw everything, or do you like, you know, how does this book come to be through your process?
Yes, yes. Well, it's interesting because I mean, I started in picture books, and when I'm working on those, it's very much a dance between writing and drawing and writing and drawing and back and forth until the story forms. But there's something about graphic novels where I have to write the script. I have to really focus on writing the story, and maybe I'll doodle something here and there, maybe sketch a few like character design ideas. I did sketch like a kind of for placement only cover. That just kind of was for inspiration that I would like, that I had tacked up on my board. But yeah, I completed the entire script. Then I created a sample scene. I illustrated a sample scene. So that was expressly to package with the script to sell it, so that an editor could look at it and could be like, this is kind of the style I'm leaning in, but it's not the final. Just so they could get a sense of what it might be like. So once we sold it, then I have to go in and like, thumbnail out the entire book. So basically that's doing like little tiny, quick, messy sketches just to figure out composition and pacing, the visual pacing. And I'll start to lay out the book in InDesign, which is, you know, like a layout program in Adobe. And, I learned the hard way from Flamer that I have to lay all the type before I really tighten up the sketches, because with Flamer, I ended up having to add 30 pages to the book just to make room for all the text. And I was so annoyed because I worked as a graphic designer for like 10 years, you know, and I'm like, other projects, it's like, oh, I know how to kind of gauge like how much room to leave for type, but there's something about speech bubbles that I'm like, it just evades me. I have no idea. So I really have to like create the bubble, fill it with the type. Sometimes I'll have, you know, an assistant help me with that. So once all the type is like figured out, then I'll start doing like tighter sketches, like around really tight sketches. And then that's where we try to do as much of the editing as possible. So working with the editor and the art director are going through, talking about what's working visually, what are some red flags, yellow flags, things that could enhance the storytelling. And then I'll go in and start doing all the final artwork. So it'll be like a round of doing all the line work, and then a round of doing all the shadows and shading and that. And then the flat color is the last touch.
Yeah, no wonder it took you a long time to work on this book. And also probably a lot of like printing proofs, you know, just to make sure everything came out correctly.
Yeah, and there, you know, we did what's called a wet proof. And that's when you try to do a few samples on what will be the actual paper, in the actual process, so that you can get a sense as close as possible to what the final book is going to look like. But with a book this size, and with our time constraints, we couldn't do like a physical proof of the entire book. So it was mostly digital proofs, and maybe like two wet proofs. And then you just gotta like let Jesus take the wheel and hope for the best. And I had an incredible pre-press team, who worked on the color, you know, like making sure the color was going to come out. And, I'm so happy with it. Like when I got, cause I was kind of holding my breath. It's like, well, we'll see. And when we got the first physical copies, I was so happy. All the colors came out so vibrant.
It's a gorgeous book. And you know, I mean, this is very like book nerdy of me, but like I love how it's bound as well, because you can like lay it flat, but that's neither here nor there. Well, thank you so much for you know, taking the time to chat with us, Mike. Where can our listeners find you?
I'm on Instagram at Mike_Corrado. Sometimes I'm on TikTok at Mike Corrado. You can always check out my website, MikeCorrado.com, for all my books and upcoming events.
Awesome. Thank you so much for joining us. And congratulations on the launch of your book, and we'll see you later.
Okay. Thanks so much for having me.
And that was Mike Corrado. His latest graphic novel, Gaysians, is available now at booksellers everywhere, including, as always, the Books and Boba bookshop. So if you want to pick up the book after listening to our conversation, head on over to booksandboba.com, check out the bookshop link. Any purchase you make on our online bookstore support not only us here at Books and Boba, but also your local bookstore. So win-win for everybody. All right. Before we go, though, Rira, can you remind us what book we are reading for June 2025?
Yeah, so we are reading After Parties, a short story collection by Anthony Viesna So, and it is a short story collection about Cambodian American life, specifically in the Bay Area. So if you guys are part of our Patreon, you'll be able to discuss the book on our Discord. If not, you can share your thoughts on socials and also on our Goodreads forums. Marvin is doing a read-along. I'm so sorry to our listeners who expect me to be more active on Discord. I will do my best to catch up. But please share your thoughts on in those spaces, and we'd love to incorporate your feedback into the discussion episode.
Yeah, as of this episode's release date, we have finished our read-along, so all plot points for all 9 short stories are up for discussion. So definitely let us know what you think, and yeah, we'll try to bring it up on our book club discussion. But with that, that'll do it for this episode of Books and Boba. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you once again to Mike Corrado for joining us, and we'll see you all next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Books and Boba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Rira Yu, and edited and produced by Marvin Yue.
follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @booksandboba and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandboba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Don't forget, you can support Books and Boba and Asian American authors by purchasing books at our bookshop.org account. Check out the link in our show notes and also at booksandboba.com. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
Life gets a little crazy sometimes. Sometimes it's confusing, sometimes it's funny, sometimes it's beautiful, and sometimes it can just piss us off. Enter First of All Podcast. It's a safe space for real conversations about the things that we all struggle with, celebrate, contemplate, and work through in our daily lives. I'm your host, Mindy Chang. I'm an actor, filmmaker, and entrepreneur with a colorful background, a full life, and brilliant friends who I love to unpack life with to share with all of you. They are everyday people like you and me, ranging from award-winning artists, cultural icons, powerful CEOs, my hilarious childhood friends, and even my mom. Tune in for honest conversations on mental health, dating, sex, family, career, culture, and everything in between. Listen to First of All wherever you find podcasts, part of the Potluck Podcast Collective.